That was the Klezmer Conservatory Band and their recording of Lebedeck in Freilach. And we first heard the Abe Schwartz recording of that same piece. My guest is Hank Osnetsky, who is the founder and leader of the Klezmer Conservatory Band. And they'll be performing Sunday evening at the Germantown Jewish Center. For more information, you can call 844-1507. Hank, is welcome to Fresh Air.
Oh, it's great to be down here.
Before we talk about your band and your interest in klezmer music, let's just get a little capsule history of what klezmer music is. It started off in Eastern Europe. What kinds of people were playing it? Where was it played?
It was played by traveling musicians who might be compared, I guess, to like trouvères and the sort of people who were traveling around Europe playing all kinds of music. In this case, they were Jewish musicians or, in many cases, gypsy musicians, but they all borrowed from each other, and the people in the Jewish tradition had a reputation for great virtuosity on instruments like the violin and the flute. And they traveled around and played their own brand of Jewish wedding and celebration music when it was permissible, which was really only at weddings and at very few celebrations during the year. And with them, there was often a jester-type figure called a batchin, who sort of is the precursor of the modern kind of comedian that you hear in the that the Jewish tradition has also helped to create here in America.
Was it a secular music?
Well, it was always a music that helped in religious occasions, not religious occasions so much as festive occasions that might be considered spiritual, like weddings, but in itself, it was a secular music that people enjoyed probably as their folk music and danced to. And really, in the Hasidic community, the music probably rose to the greatest heights and has been an undying kind of tradition.
When some of those musicians emigrated to America, how did the music change?
I think the American version of klezmer and Yiddish theater music has in it a lot of Americanisms that come from vaudeville and come from the early music hall here. And the songs were immediately influenced. The composers adapted very quickly here and picked up ragtime rhythms and new instruments like saxophones and slide trombones and the drums, the different kinds of drums that they were using here. And I think the singers also heard new styles of singing here and picked that up.
Let's listen to a recording that was one of the recording by one of the clarinetists who first interested you when you started listening to klezmer recordings. And this is Naftuli Brandwine. Can you say a little bit about the performer and the record before we hear it?
Sure. This is a Romanian hora, which is a Romanian gypsy kind of rhythm, and it's in fact, the whole sound, all the ornaments and the very vocalized kind of sound on the clarinet really was what got me interested in this. This was the first clarinetist who I heard play in this old style. I'd heard many, many records on the radio that were more modern, but this recording, which is from the early 20s of Brandwine, and many of his other recordings were some of the first that really interested me in this style. And this is called Führende Machetunim Ahem, which means escorting the in-laws home. Jewish wedding in the old days wasn't something that happened in 3 hours and then it was over with. It was something that lasted all week during the time of the period that they still have in the Orthodox community of the Sheva Brachas. Every evening there would be another. In fact, all day there would be celebrations at the houses of all the various in-laws, and there would be these various tunes that were used to escort the members of the family around the shtetl, or even in this country, around maybe 4th Street in South Philly. So this is one of those types of tunes used for escorting the in-laws. But I think it really demonstrates the clarinet virtuosity of Brandwine.
Let's hear it. Thank you. was klezmer clarinetist Naftuli Brandwine, and my guest is Hank Osnetsky, the founder and leader of the Klezmer Conservatory Band. Well, that was a beautiful recording that we just heard, but I bet it's nothing like the Yiddish or Jewish music you grew up listening to.
No, I find it to be a little more old-fashioned, a little more, a little less nostalgic, maybe. Really, it sounds like the real thing. And to me, a lot of the things that I, you know, that I think I grew up with didn't sound like the real thing. They sounded like some kind of remembrance of something that existed, sort of like this was Jewish music sort of approach, you know, but not really in the moment.
What do you remember hearing at bar mitzvahs and weddings? What was standard fare when the musicians would get around to playing the Jewish part of the repertoire?
I think they would play the songs that became popular in the 60s from mostly the Israeli tradition, mostly Horas. The whole symbolism of the positive Jewish experience really in the 60s came from Israeli culture, because the remembrance of the Yiddish culture was often associated with the ghetto, with hard times, with times that people didn't want to talk about. And there was this new, very positive thing that people could identify with, and which came somewhat out of Europe also, which often many of the Israeli tunes were originally Russian tunes or Yiddish tunes. So there was something there, but it really had switched over to that sort of realm, and people were tending to associate more with that. And the Yiddish stuff did tend to be either a more nostalgic treatment or spoofs on the old Yiddish stuff. That was even more common, to hear things that were spoofs. And now I'm really learning to appreciate those spoofs now that I sort of know what the tradition is. In fact, I'm beginning to really like, you know, for example, Mickey Katz's stuff. There were musicians who kept this tradition alive and were still doing it and doing creative stuff in the early 60s, but without the background in the traditional stuff and the original kind of klezmer music, it was very hard for a young person to be appreciating what those musicians were doing.
I don't know if you had this experience, but I know from weddings and bar mitzvahs that I attended when I was young that there'd be a union band that had the standard repertoire of horrors, of some Yiddish folk songs and pop tunes, and then the current pop hits like The Twist or The Peppermint Twist or whatever was on the charts and manageable for them at the time. And I really disliked a lot of the Yiddish music that was played. And looking back, I think that they did the same thing to the Yiddish music that they did to The Twist, which was,
well,
get it all wrong.
I really feel those musicians are some of the best musicians at playing this stuff, but in fact the public very often dragged the standard along with whatever the norm was in popular music. And in order to even get away with playing Yiddish music and get away with playing the old tunes, they had to do them in some kind of souped up modern style for the people to listen to it. If they actually played it in the old style, they just thought they'd lose the audience, and they were probably right.
Well, did you like that music when you heard it, or did it alienate you?
It didn't really hit me one way or the other. I grew up, though, listening to some really fine cantorial music, and I was very much a fan of all the various fine cantors that my own congregation, which is from Mott El and Mount Airy, had. And that was always a tremendous mystery to me. I didn't understand it that much, but I sang in our synagogue choir, and I you know, I heard these fantastic improvisations that the chazanim would do, and I was always very impressed with that. We also had a Hasidic shul near our house, and I heard Hasidic music there, and I learned to play a little bit for them. But I didn't really have any tie-in with the old-fashioned klezmer music, so that when I'd play for the chassidim, I'd often, you know, end up playing things from Fiddler on the Roof.
Well, let's listen to another selection from one of your albums, from the Klezmer Conservatory Band. And from the second album, we're going to hear Yiddel Mitten Fiddle.
Right. Yiddel Mitten Fiddle is the title tune from a movie. This is a Yiddish theater song written by Abe Elstein for Molly Pekan, who is, by the way, from Philadelphia. It's a portrait, in fact, of musicians, Yiddel Mitten Fiddle and Aryeh Mitten Bass, two klezmers, two old-style klezmers riding on a hay wagon and just saying, why get angry? Das Leben ist ein Spaß. Life is just a joke. You might as well laugh.
Why did you want to do this song?
Why did I want to do this song? Because it was a request, first of all, from somebody who's a friend of the band who really liked this song and suggested we do it. And then when we heard it, we found it very uplifting, and we found it challenging as an arrangement, in fact, because we do practically everything from the original arrangement. And it has a tremendous blend of the old style sort of dance, the very romantic gypsy violin at the beginning. And it also has a little bit of very 40s-ish Jewish mode, you know, going in the middle, a very sort of 40s-ish foxtrot sort of sound that stays within the Jewish tradition but also is very influenced by swing. So it was really right in the middle of our repertoire.
Okay, this is Yiddelmit and Fiddle from the album Klez. That's the second album by the Klezmer Conservatory Band. And with me is the band's founder and leader, Hank Osnetsky.
Spiel die Fiedel, spiel von mir a liebe Lied, nur die weißt allein, wie es nuckt in Sied. Spiel die Fiedel, spiel, bis die Strun es platzen dir, nur die weißt, wo sich fiel. Tu spiel die steht auf der Lanke in Mecke treurig, meh! Hey, du zick, du scheute, treurig sein ist fair. Schuckelt er das Pferdl in Tage, Tage fair. Jeder mit dem Fiedl, alle mit dem Bass. Das Leben ist ein Lidl, du wirst es seinen Kass. Hey, jeder Fiedl, Schmiedl, hey, das Leben ist ein Spaß. Vogel flieht, geht morgen, a geht jur. Dem treuer in die Sorgen, sa all de schwarze jur. Dem Pinter lach in Ponem, in jidla, jidla fuhe. Jidl mit dem Fiedl, aje mit dem Bass. Das Leben is a Leben, du wirst es seinen Kass. Hey, Jidl, Fiedl, Schmiedl, hey. Das Leben ist ein Spaß.
Yiddelmit and Fiddle, and that's the Klezmer Conservatory Band from their second album, Klez, and my guest is Hank Osnetsky, the founder of the band, and he's also a pianist and saxophonist. Well, when you discovered klezmer music, did you feel like you had come upon your musical roots?
I felt like the work that I'd done to try to play a kind of vocalized music that really appealed to me in Greek music and in blues and all that, it became very obvious to me that there was something much closer that I could actually apply my, you know, aural skills as far as the skills I'd developed to learn to listen to ethnic music. I'd applied them in all kinds of directions, and when it came to applying them to klezmer music, it became very obvious that there was a source there that I had grown up hearing, and that I was familiar with, but it just had to be unlocked, and that was clear to me that there was something that was closer, that was part of the whole way that I grew up hearing people talk, the whole kind of Yiddish syntax, in the American Jewish community, there's so much of that still there, and you know, that kind of thing. My brother was pointing out today, it was funny, when we were in the radio in New York, he was hearing the Chock Full of Nuts commercial, and he pointed out like an expression like, better coffee a millionaire's money can't buy. That must be from Yiddish. You know, things like that. So anyhow, probably grew up, hearing people express themselves that way. In my own expression, there was a lot of that that just was waiting to come out. And here was a music where it could.
How did you find it?
Well, I knew it must be there. I grew up, in fact, with an old picture of my grandfather's band as it was in around 1920. My grandfather was a drummer, played a lot of different instruments. Cal Katz was his name, and he led an orchestra here in Philadelphia at several of the catering houses in South Philly. And I think I knew that one of my uncles who was in that picture, who played cornet, Dr. Samuel Katz, was still around, but I had maybe met him once, and I was in college already, and I was thinking, okay, I study all this ethnic music, and there must be some old-fashioned Jewish music. I'd caught a glimpse of it in some old music, printed manuscripts I'd seen, and I had Yiddish theater sheet music around the house, but I didn't know what it sounded like. So I called up my Uncle Sam, and he invited me over. And it turned out that he had not only his own collection of 78s, also 78s collected by my great-grandfather, who was an amateur Yiddish theater actor also. And when I heard those records, I discovered something that I knew had to exist, but I had never heard.
Did you find that you could play it really easily, that because you'd grown up with similar rhythms and with the Yiddish inflections, that it was just easier to pick it up, easier than maybe Greek folk music was for you?
I don't think that any of the young revival klezmer musicians are really claiming to be that authentic as far as that goes. When we say we pick it up, we pick up what we can perceive of it and what is intact and what is within our whole area of expression. It's just not that possible for somebody growing up in this world now, I think, to sound exactly like somebody who was growing up in the 20s and to have exactly the same kind of feeling. But there was a feeling, an empathy with the sounds of the music. I don't know exactly why, but I found that certain aspects of it I could understand rather easily, and I could do it in my own way and feel good about it. That's all I can say.
Did you decide to drop other parts of your playing to pursue the klezmer?
Well, it showed me some things about other types of playing that I did. Why maybe on the oboe, for example, I was never satisfied with getting a pure, simple classical oboe sound, and why why my teacher had to beat me over the head not to bend notes. It's so tempting on the oboe, and yet you're not really allowed to do it in classical music. And I had a tendency to do things like that. So certain habits, in fact, that I think might have been ingrained at an early age, maybe from hearing cantorial music or as I say, speech patterns, I was allowed to express them and nobody was stopping me. In fact, it was obvious that they were very much part of the music.
You had been playing jazz too, right?
Yeah. And rhythmically, it sort of made me think a little bit about my jazz playing, I think.
When did you decide to start the band, and how did you go about finding other musicians who'd be interested in playing klezmer music?
I basically organized very open jam sessions in Philadelphia for musicians. Actually, thinking about how to disseminate the music, I came across, while I was in Philadelphia, I went to a session held by Mick Maloney, who does Irish music in a very similar way and teaches a lot of fine Irish musicians, Irish traditional music, and also other musicians from the community go to those sessions and learn the Irish traditional music. And I decided to try a similar technique in Boston with my records and brought them to New England Conservatory, where I teach, and called it Klezmer Conservatory, which was kind of a contradiction because klezmers were really the most itinerant and poor and untrained conservatory-wise musicians. But I called it Klezmer Conservatory, and young musicians who wanted to do this kind of music became interested. I sort of advertised in my classes, and we had these sessions. And finally, one of the students at the conservatory organized a Jewish music concert at New England Conservatory, which was the first concert of its kind to be held at that school. And I decided my contribution would be to collect together the various musicians who had been at these sessions and to put together maybe three songs in the old style, try to play them exactly, you know, as close to the old records as we could. But of course, we'd sound like young people doing it. And we did it at the end of the concert, and the crowd went wild. And we were drafted, basically. I mean, we got calls all the next week asking us to play concerts. We had to learn some new songs quickly. And that was about 4.5 years ago. And we've been doing it ever since. We've never had to really promote ourselves. It's always been people coming after us about it.
One of the really interesting things about the band is, contrary to what a lot of our listeners might expect, not all of the musicians are Jewish. It's not all, you know, a part of their heritage, so to speak. There's several non-Jewish musicians in it. The lead clarinetist is a black musician whose father is, I think, a calypso musician.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the kind of classical cliche question, you know, can white people play the blues? Has there been a similar kind of discussion, you know, about klezmer music? You know, do non-Jewish people play it differently than Jewish people do?
In fact, I mean, the kind of grief that people give our clarinetists sometime, I mean, you know, when I think of in fact, how much accepted it is that white people do play the blues, I think of how easily a lot of white musicians have gotten away with it. I mean, of course it's possible for anybody to play any kind of music the way that they play it. If people like the way that they play it, then it's going to catch on. And whatever they bring to it is what they bring to it, and it's going to make their own way of playing it very special. In the case of our clarinetist, what he brings to our music is a very creative spirit and a tremendous knowledge of playing modal music, which is something that a lot of young Jewish musicians don't have, especially if they didn't grow up really hearing a sort of authentic kind of canter. But he's, you know, a young jazz musician who's listened to Coltrane might have more of a chance of being able to express himself very creatively in that way. Also, a sense of humor that's fantastic, and that is formed probably in the, you know, in the Bronx in New York, in a neighborhood where there were a lot of Jewish people around, and probably has a little bit of the same kind of ironic Jewish kind of spirit. There is a lot of closeness in Jewish humor and black humor, I think.
I think sometimes the assumption when someone says, "Why would you want to play this if you're not Jewish?" is, why are you playing this if you're not Jewish? is, why would you want to play it? Why would you be interested in it if you're not Jewish?
That's true. That's true also. And it's all that you can say is that anything is fair game these days. People are discovering a lot of things that appeal to them for all kinds of reasons. And someone who's looking for something to do that reflects the kinds of feelings they have about music has a lot more to choose from now than they had 50 years ago.
Well, sometimes people use music as a kind of closed society, something to separate you from other people. Would you like klezmer music to have the same kind of appeal as other traditional and ethnic musics do? And I'm thinking, like, you know, Cajun music is very popular.
We feel that
here.
It does. We really feel very strongly that we don't put any barrier there. We don't create any kind of feeling that this is music that's in a closed sort of society. Probably a lot of the if there was any closedness in the 20s, and if people were not hearing it, it was more fear that the Jewish community had, and for very good reasons through the a thousand years in the European exile, and being chased from town to town, and really just the only closeness that they had was within their own community. And in this country, it has been better, and it's been a situation where people are, certainly third generation Jewish kids, are not afraid to share their identities with other people at this point.
Do your uncles who used to play this music think that you're crazy for reviving it?
Well, not at this point.
They used to,
and
know,
in
right?
fact, the uncle who played me the first bunch of records has been so encouraging from the very beginning. I think I think almost when he played me those first, you know, first records almost 10 years ago, you know, he said to me, "You should do this. You should do this. You know, you should form a band. You should do this music." I think that kind of encouragement was what I got. It's interesting though. He's someone who had been out of the music business for about 40 years and had become a dentist. And another uncle of mine who was who's also in Philadelphia and had stayed in the music business. At first thought, how could I possibly plan to do anything with this? The people won't want it, and it won't go anywhere. You'll starve, you know. And he was, you know, he didn't think it was possible. And this is someone who amassed volumes of notated manuscripts of the music and really documented it very well. This is my uncle Jerry Adler, who's a clarinetist on the scene for quite a while and still is. And ever since I brought him the first tape of what our band actually sounded like, he's been tremendously encouraging. He realized that it's actually possible, and it really gives the older people who grew up with this music and tried to pass it on a tremendous amount of encouragement when they see young people doing it and enjoying it without being told it's good for you, you know, just going out and trying to get it on their own.
What about your parents? What's their reaction been?
Their reaction was probably at first very similar to my Uncle Jerry's reaction, I guess, that they didn't know where it would go. They heard me doing it. It wasn't stuff that really was the big band music that they really loved, you know, especially, I mean, my mother's favorite was always Frank Sinatra. We have a big photo of Frank Sinatra in our living room, bigger than any of us, you know. But this music, once she heard it and once she heard how we're doing it, it's become one of her favorites now, and it's really catching on also, I think, in that generation.
My guest is Hank Osnetsky. He's the founder and leader of the Klezmer Conservatory Band, and he teaches at the New England Conservatory of Music in Boston. Did I get that right?
Yeah.
Doesn't sound right.
New England Conservatory of Music.
Okay.
They've been around a while. You could suggest they change their name.
let's listen to another recording, and you've discussed a little bit some of the American pop influences on the Jewish musicians who emigrated here. And we're going to hear a piece from your first album. This is called Yiddish Blues. And we're going to hear another piece of klezmer music recorded somewhere in the 20s or 30s after that. Maybe you can set up both of these pieces for us.
Yeah, there really was a movement to try to create what a friend of mine, Henry Sapoznik, likes to call shmata time, which was sort of a whole movement with among these Jewish musicians to take their old modes that are in Hasidic music, in cantorial music, and create a very American kind of dance music that used the same kinds of old-fashioned Jewish modal patterns and scales and had that Oriental kind of sound, but with a ragtime kind of beat, with, in fact, whatever kind of beat came along. And the first example is us playing this the Yiddish blues, which sounds very much like a Yiddish maple leaf rag. It really sounds like it's coming out of Scott Joplin. This was done by Lieutenant Joseph Frankel's orchestra, Lieutenant Joseph Frankel was a band leader here in Philadelphia, in fact, and he led the band at Woolgrove Park. He was a Pennsylvania State Militia band leader, and also very active doing Hasidic music in New York, and did some fascinating records, including this one. And the second one is by a crossover band that really was a swing band, Nathan Glantz and his orchestra, and this is called the Yiddisher Charleston. And you'll hear something a little bit more modern, in fact, than Lieutenant Frankel's band, a sort of another step. I guess the Frankel band represents the teens, and then this Yiddisher Charleston represents the 20s. So it really continued into the 30s and 40s also with the dance rhythms of those times.
Okay, and the set opens with the Klezmer Conservatory Band's recording of Yiddish Blues from their first album, Yiddish Renaissance.
Thank you.
That was the Yiddish at Charleston with Nathan Glantz and his orchestra. And we opened that set with a recording from the Klezmer Conservatory Band's album, Klez. Well, when you started playing the klezmer music, which and the Yiddish folk songs that have Yiddish lyrics, did you find yourself becoming more religious in any way? Because there is a whole Jewish revival going on, especially among people of your generation.
Well, I think what happened, what's been happening in the Jewish cultural area has had a different impression on people with different kinds of orientation. I think that that people who are oriented toward music maybe are finding their revival in this kind of music and perhaps in religious affiliation also. But in fact, I find that a lot of my friends who are into philosophy, for example, and really into religions, maybe who studied comparative religions growing up and were really into philosophical kinds of thought, are tending to be the ones who are more involved in, say, the Chavurah movement and the sort of religious-oriented Jewish movement. And maybe the people who are involved in various kinds of crafts are getting involved in things like paper cutting and calligraphy and things like that. And I think that there's an entire culture out there. It's not only a religion. The Jewish civilization really is a very old thing, and there are aspects of all types for people of various kinds of orientation. I feel like my cultural identity is there, and I'm glad that this music is there that really interests me. And there are aspects of the religion that appeal to me too, but it's not my primary affiliation.
Did you find yourself ever trying to suppress certain Jewish stylings in your music before you actually started playing Jewish music?
I think that I didn't really recognize them before I started playing the Jewish music. I found myself as a jazz musician. It was interesting. The musician that appealed to me the most of all the jazz musicians is somebody who maybe is a little bit obscure. I don't know if he's played that much down here. Is a fellow named Randy Weston, who comes very much out of Duke Ellington's tradition, but goes into Middle Eastern kinds of sounds and African kinds of sounds. And I was very much drawn to Randy Weston's music in that I learned a lot of it on the piano and really tried to play it and did big band arrangements of his music. And I looked for that kind of expression. I didn't know why I was looking for it, but in fact it was something very close to the kinds of ornamentation that's in klezmer music.
You've been teaching klezmer music at the New England Conservatory of Music. Are there any problems that this kind of fairly improvisational music, untutored music presents to you as a teacher?
Well, when I finally was given my first course, which really was only this spring, they finally did add a Jewish ethnic music course as one of a series of courses in ethnic music that they're going to have there. I found that the students coming to it had to figure out how to relearn these sounds on their instruments. They had to really start from scratch with their instruments and figure out how to approach them. And at first, I couldn't figure out how to do it. And then I realized that they really had to sing Hasidic nigunim. They had to listen to Hasidim, recordings of Hasidim. And in order to have any idea of what the ornamentation and the whole articulation of the music was and the rhythm of the music was, they had to actually sing. They had to actually sing these nigunim the way that they were sung and learn the kinds of portamentos and slides and trills and things that these Hasidim do vocally and that has been a part of Eastern European Jewish culture always, but that these students maybe weren't aware of. Actually, only one person in my class is Jewish, so it wasn't really part of their backgrounds. And yet they were attracted to Jewish music, but when it came to playing it, they didn't really hear these ornaments. And what happens, of course, when they learn it is they come up with their own versions of them. But I found that it really took the vocal approach, and that has always been true in Jewish music, that vocal music has been the most significant.
When the band plays together, do you wear certain clothes or anything that would be indicative of the period of the music that you're playing? Do you like to do that or avoid it?
We tried. Basically, the personalities in the band are very diverse, and as I mentioned, I really don't think the band is a nostalgia phenomenon. we don't feel comfortable representing this as a nostalgia thing. We play it because we like it, and we play it because it appeals to us now. And basically, what happened is any semblance of the old-fashioned dress. Well, basically, whatever. They're encouraged to wear things like vests, you know, and ties. But the ties started getting narrower when punk started coming in, you know, and different kinds of styles started creeping in that weren't really legislated so much. So the band dresses sort of as a combination of old and new, I think.
The songs are sung in Yiddish. You could translate the lyrics and sing them in English. Why do you choose to keep them in Yiddish?
They sound terrible in English. I mean, they just really sound awful. And they were created in Yiddish, and so many sentiments that can be expressed in Yiddish can't be expressed in English. And, you know, as Molly Pickens said, you know, when she was autographing a copy of her book, and she had spoken in Yiddish, and somebody said, you know, And I said to her, how, you know, I didn't really understand what you said. She said, you should learn Yiddish. You know, that's it. That's the only way you're going to understand what she said. You know, she doesn't have to say it in English because it wouldn't be the same thing.
Had you resisted learning Yiddish when you were younger?
No, I wanted to learn Yiddish, actually. I took all the courses that were available. My parents actually sent me to a place where I could take a Yiddish course when I was in high school. And when I was in college, I took some extension division Yiddish, but it wasn't possible to get a very big education in Yiddish at that point. I didn't really have the opportunity to learn the language well. Finally, at Harvard, I got a chance to sit in on a course and learn much more about it. And just this past summer, the intensive program, the Weinreich program at Columbia University that the YIVO runs in New York, I managed to take that, and now I'm much more fluent.
You've mentioned that klezmer music is similar to modal jazz, but there's something that some people sometimes call the Jewish mode. what would that be? What is that mode? Is there any way you could describe it?
Yeah, want
it?
Me to sing.
Yeah.
There are two modes that came into Jewish music possibly from other Eastern European cultures or from somewhere else in the Orient, fairly late, but that are sort of looked upon as the quintessential kinds of Jewish modes, and one of them is the Ukrainian Dorian mode, which is this like, and that's one of them, and the one thing that's interesting about that is that I think the early musicians hearing blues probably thought that the blues mode was the sort of minor blues sound was very close to that, because there's one kind of vocal ornament that the blues sort of adds in that changes that mode and makes it sound a little more closer to blues. That turning around right there, if you do that, all of a sudden it starts sounding a little like blues ornaments. So these Jewish musicians who had this mode very ingrained probably changed it around and thought that they were much closer to blues. And that's true of this tune that we play called the Yiddish Blues. There's also the one that Hava Nagila is in, which is like which is in cantorial music called a Friggish mode. And it's very much like a Greek mode. It's like the Hejaz Arabic makam, and it's something that is identified with Jewish music very heavily. Those two modes, I think, are the ones that people identify with Yiddish music a lot. There are many other cantorial modes, though.
When you teach students, do you teach them those modes like on staff paper, or it's just mostly through singing?
Well, I show them that if they're going to learn those modes, and they're going to learn Jewish usage of those modes, it will take them years. If they're really going to learn to improvise, they'll need to study cantorial music. I also need to study cantorial music. I can recognize from growing up in a shul-oriented community, I can recognize the ornaments. And in fact, if somebody gave me that collection of notes, the improvisations I would do would have the sort of Jewish motives that I grew up hearing, the motives that are in the prayers, and because I know some of those. For some of these students, those they would take that same collection of notes and play them in a different order that doesn't sound at all Jewish. So they have to learn everything from the very start. Some people are quick at picking that up, though.
Do you hear Jewish influences in jazz, you know, especially from the Jewish jazz musicians who were famous in the 20s and 30s and 40s?
There probably was a big influence on American popular music, I would say, from the Jewish musicians. There you could make a case for there being an influence from Jewish music onto jazz. It all depends on what you're going to call jazz. And once things got really very mixed up together as far as the jazz tradition came in, okay, well, there were recordings that were done in the 20s and 30s with Ted Lewis, for example, I know, and Benny Goodman playing a very Jewish sounding kind of thing. And there were recordings like And the Angels Sing, people like Ziggy Elman using the Jewish stuff and doing a little bit of improvisation. But and there was probably some give and take. Maybe the jazz musicians, maybe somebody heard somebody playing a Doyne on the clarinet and picked up those kinds of glissandi and trills and things like that, and it influenced some New Orleans jazz musicians. The jazz tradition itself is very, you know, very rich in itself, and it's probably a small influence.
So you'll be continuing to play klezmer music?
Oh yeah.
You'd be performing jazz as well, or
I perform various types of music. I don't really draw very many boundaries of what I play. I'll play what people think I can play well.
Well, it's been a lot of fun. Maybe you can come back on another visit to Philadelphia, and we can play some more records and talk some more. It'll be fun.